From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. On today's program, we talk to Detroit Mayor Dave Bing about the state of the city.
We need to get away from all of the infighting, the finger-pointing, the backbiting. Look, a lot of good things are happening.
And a conversation about the stage performance of My Brother Marvin with the director and Marvin Gaye's little sister.
Well, we don't know the truth about life with Marvin, and no one can tell that better than Ziola Gaye, who was there in the home.
And it's Valentine's Day. Just another Hallmark holiday, or is it love?
Look at this guy at the end of the bar. He is checking out that woman over by the jukebox. Oh, he's making his move.
That and much more coming up, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Universities across the country are opening up campus housing to transgender students, and it's happening right here in Michigan. On today's show, we'll talk about gender-inclusive campus housing. Then we'll be talking with Marvin Gaye's little sister about a stage performance on his life. And it's Valentine's Day. We'll bring you stories of love and disappointment. But first, last night, Detroit Mayor Dave Bing reaffirmed the city's financial troubles and outlined some of the ways his administration has worked to cut costs and still maintain basic city services. He introduced programs to demolish the Brewster Housing Project and establish a Detroit Blight Authority. The mayor said the story of Detroit is not all doom and gloom. And, quote, "We can't, we won't give up on our city."
It's time to change the conversation about Detroit. It's time to focus on the many positive changes taking place.
Mayor Bing joins us now. Mr. Mayor, you acknowledged you walked into a fiscal mess when you took office and said the city's options are not pretty, but you also laid a good portion of the city's money problems at the feet of state government. Would you explain that?
We have had for the past 11 years, state revenue sharing has declined to the tune of about $702 million. Had we had that money, Detroit would not be in the fix that it's in today. Since I've been in office since 2009, the state's revenue sharing has declined $94 million. So once again, the state has balanced its budget on the backs of some of its major cities, and this being the largest city, it has hurt us more than anybody else.
You introduced the Detroit Blight Authority, and there's a pilot program. What is this, and where will you start?
We've got a pilot program that is underway, headed up by the Pulte family, but they've engaged other stakeholders in the city of Detroit to help us clean up some of the blight, and we're going to do it in large swaths across the city. We have not determined where we're going to go next. But one of the things that I'm very pleased with, to date, it doesn't cost the city any money. Pulte and the other stakeholders in the private area are doing this on their own to help clean up the city, and I'm totally appreciative toward that.
You listed public safety, public lighting, public transportation, and neighborhood blight as top priorities and outlined progress in those areas. What further changes can we expect so that Detroit is safer?
We've got to make improvements in every one of those areas. We've got to get the bonds sold so that we can start looking at what we can do to bring lights back on in the city. We're working toward that end as I speak. Over on the transportation side, it's not going to happen overnight, but we're working very closely with the federal government for additional equipment, additional technology, and that's going to help us, I think, with on-time service. As we look at blight across the city, we've already talked about that. And one of the things that we haven't talked about is the whole financial stress that the city has been under for a long time. We are addressing those problems. Initially, we were having all kinds of cash flow problems, but we have solved that in the short term. We don't have cash flow problems throughout the rest of this fiscal year, which ends on June 30th. Doesn't mean that we solved the problem. It's short term, and we've got to now deal with some of the long term obligations that we have.
You talked about the number of city employees being reduced from something more than 13,000 to something more than 9,000. on the payroll. Yesterday, I want to talk about one of our reporters was at Pershing High School where there was a gang fight. The police gang task force responded. One of the concerns is that you plan to dissolve the gang squad, redistribute those officers to different precincts, diminishing or eliminating its effectiveness. Why are you doing that?
What we're doing is putting the gang squads or those officers back into the precincts. It doesn't mean that they're not going to watch and get information on what's happening as far as gangs are concerned. If you were to compare our city to some of the other major metropolitan areas, Miami or Chicago or L.A., they have huge gang problems. We don't have huge gang problems. We've got young individuals that are fighting over turf more than anything else. And we think that we can help solve the problem by putting the police officers into the precincts where a lot of this activity is going on.
One of the police officers indicates that's like putting them in the precinct to push paper rather than actually be on the scene and help stop some of these conflicts.
Not true. You talk to one police officer, that doesn't mean that's the direction that we're going in. I think the chief knows exactly what he's doing. There are more and more police that are going to be on the street. I think I said last night that about 80% of our police office will be on the street. About 15% will be in the investigative union, in the investigative area, and about 5% will be in administration. So we're not looking at people pushing paper. We get them away from that, getting them out in the street where the activity is.
You're listening to Stateside, and we're talking with Detroit Mayor Dave Bing about his State of the City address delivered last night. Other than an oblique reference to there being no emergency manager to date and no bankruptcy, you really didn't address the very real possibility of a state-appointed emergency financial manager. Why not?
Because I don't have control of that. Why should I talk about something that I have no control of? The governor is the one that has control, and that question should be in his lap, not mine. We're doing everything that we can to correct the problems that we have in the city. I will continue to focus on that. I can't spend a lot of time worrying about whether or not an emergency manager is going to come in, because if I don't focus and do the things that I'm supposed to do, that will happen.
You said, quote, my job is not done, hinting you might run, but you've...
I didn't hint anything. All I've said is my job's not done, and it isn't done. I mean, in 4 years that I've been here, I inherited a 40-year mess. You can't fix it in 4 years. So my job is not done, and I got to continue to work to fix as many problems as I can.
So what do you hope that Detroit citizens take away from your State of the City address last night?
That we are doing positive things in the city. We need to get away from all of the infighting, the finger-pointing, the backbiting. Look, a lot of good things are happening. That's what we ought to be promoting, and stop trying to make us fight against each other. When we fight against each other, nobody wins.
What do you do as you move forward now?
I continue to focus on those four areas that I talked about, and that would be public safety, that would be public lighting, that would be public transportation, that would be elimination of blight. If I do those things, I think the city starts to come back as fast as it can.
Mr. Mayor, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Joining us now to talk further about the mayor's speech is Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter, Sarah Swick. First, Sarah, what was your overall impression of what the mayor had to say last night?
It sounded very much to me like he very much wanted to focus on the positive. In fact, he said that about changing the conversation about Detroit and really sort of highlighting a list of his signature policy initiatives that he feels like they have truly made some progress on, that being the fight against blight and vacant housing, the Detroit Works Project, all of now the Detroit Future City Plan, a long-term plan for the city. So he did briefly address the city's financial problems at the beginning, but it sounded very much more like someone talking about their legacy, about the groundwork that they've laid going into the future.
We've seen some criticism that while he was upbeat, the mayor really didn't do much to comfort Detroit citizens that their lives are going to get much better anytime soon, or that they can feel more safe, or that emergency help will respond any quicker. Did you hear anything like that?
I didn't, and a few people that I've talked to afterward had said, I don't necessarily know what people's expectations were going into this, but they had hoped to hear something a little bit more solid, at least some kind of vision from him about dealing with this short-term cash crisis that Detroit is in and the prospect, imminent prospect of an emergency manager coming in, possibly coming into the city. So people did, I think, in general, want to hear a bit more of that, and they really didn't.
I thought it was interesting when he talked about crime in the city. He talked about crime going down, except for homicides, and then saying the fight against crime must involve everyone. That could be, I think, kind of interpreted badly when you consider the time it takes for police or fire to respond because personnel are scattered so sparsely across the city. So his answer is more police mini stations. How will that fix that, and how are we all supposed to fight homicide?
The Detroit Police Department just internally has had a really difficult time during Mayor Bing's administration. There have been several police chiefs. The current police chief, Chester Logan, is actually an interim chief. There's a search on for a new one that appears to be going rather slowly. But this is sort of what we've heard from them continually about crime is, well, first of all, they'll say overall crime is down. Yes, we do have this murder problem. I don't know if that's particularly comforting to people, living in the city. But we do need, everyone to be involved in this. But we also need to reorganize the police department a little bit. I think people are at this point just want to see some sort of action. They want to see some police on the streets. They want to see Mayor Bing has promised to put 80% of the police department on patrol. I think people want to see that before anyone's really going to feel any differently. And it's just there's sort of this pervasive sense that crime in Detroit goes unpunished. And I think until people see more of a police presence, that is not going to change.
Let me ask you to speculate a little bit. We heard the mayor last night. Will anything the mayor plans matter much now if the governor appoints an emergency financial manager?
I think it's interesting because I talked to Chris Andrews, who is the program management director of the city. He's an appointed person who came on after the city got into a financial stability agreement with the state last year. And he was talking about long-term restructuring, and they've hired these outside advisors, counselors, law firms, turnaround artists, basically, to sort of help them. So in one sense, I don't know how much control or how much input the mayor and the city council will really have if an emergency manager comes in, and it seems at this point like one probably will at some point. But it seems like a lot of the groundwork is sort of being laid already for trying to restructure and reorganize the city in a way that I think they're hoping that they can avoid going through bankruptcy. But they're setting the stage for, I think, the worst case scenario.
All right. Sarah Swick is a Michigan radio journalist. She covers Detroit City Hall and anything else the city throws at her. All right. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Up next, campus housing for transgender students and a conversation with Marvin Gaye's little sister about the stage performance of My Brother Marvin. That story coming up in 15 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. The University of Michigan Housing has announced it will set aside a block of gender-neutral rooms for transgender and gender nonconforming students in the fall of 2013 as a part of the gender-inclusive living experience. This idea is not without controversy. When former U of M student body president Chris Armstrong promoted the idea, he was attacked online by then-Assistant State Attorney General Andrew Chevelle. Chevelle later lost a lawsuit because of his actions, as you might recall. Our guests today are Amy Navab, who is a student at the University of Michigan and the chair of the Open Housing Initiative, and Amanda Hobson, who is the residential coordinator at Ohio University, where gender-neutral housing is already available to students. Amy Navab, let's start with you. First, explain who will be able to choose these dorms and what option this choice gives them as far as roommates.
Yes. So the Gender Inclusive Living application went live in January, and it is open to all students regardless of gender expression, but it's an intentional community for those who identify as transgender and gender nonconforming. So the reason why it's very open is that we really want to encourage allies to be able to step up and live with students in a community that's supportive.
So what's it say about society as a whole when a big university such as Michigan is deciding to do this?
I think it says that the University of Michigan wants to be supportive of all students and ensure that regardless of your gender expression, you are going to feel safe and comfortable in your living environment.
So how much might this change the way we all talk and think about gender in the future? Because this is transgender is the one part of LGBT that's not talked about a lot among the general population.
I think it opens up a conversation for students. I know working with the Open Housing Initiative over the past few years, we often were in a situation of explaining different gender identity to students, and it wasn't something that students necessarily were against, but it was something that they just didn't know about and know how to talk about. So I think this is definitely opening up the conversation.
Amanda Hobson at Ohio University, how has gender-neutral dorms affected attitudes about gender issues there?
I think one of the most key things that it has done at Ohio University is really just bring trans issues and gender identity and expression to the table. For our students, the ability to be more open and to make choices based upon compatibility and based on what may be the most safe and inclusive environment has really opened our students' experiences and made them more comfortable to then go out into the rest of the campus and do more activism and more talking about these issues. So they are on the table to talk about on the campus as a whole more.
Has there been anyone within the community or within the state who has expressed some opposition to this idea?
You know, initially when we began talking about it, we were quite concerned about pushback and resistance. We actually did not receive a lot of resistance for our project when we were in the implementation and development phase, and we've not received much since we've instituted it. So one of the things that we were very thoughtful about was how do we communicate with our constituents, whether that be our students or parents or potential students and parents of our institution, why this was important to us. So we didn't receive any pushback from the state or anything like that, though we did anticipate it.
So how important has the creation of a community like this, a place to live with others who understand gender identity questions, how important has that been for the students?
It has been incredibly important. When doing our assessment with the students in last year during the pilot program, it became very apparent that some of our students probably would have left our institution had it not been for the implementation of gender-neutral housing here. So just for a few students alone, they stayed. We retained those students, which is incredibly important in higher education. But more importantly, all of our students that found that place found a home at Ohio University that they may not have found before, regardless of their gender identity or expression.
Amy DeVob, how's the application response been so far?
I think it's been overwhelmingly positive. I don't have the exact numbers of who has been applying, but we are excited to open this option up to incoming freshmen. And the majority of students who live in the dorms are freshmen and sophomores, so it will be exciting that this will be available to the incoming students for the fall.
Besides this Andrew Chervell incident, has there been a lot of controversy on campus at Michigan about this?
No, there really hasn't. It's been something that people in general, when we started talking about it, just didn't know this was an issue in the first place, that students might not feel comfortable in the dorms as a result of their gender. So I think the campaign for gender-inclusive housing has been a big teaching experience across the university.
And I guess what I want to ask is, was there an outcry for this? Were there a lot of transgender and other gender identity issues that will be answered by this? And were people pressuring the university to do this?
Yeah, I think there has been a lot of pressure from student voices across campus, both students who identify as transgender or gender nonconforming and ally students who feel that being comfortable in the dorms is just a right that all students should have.
I've asked this question, a similar question earlier, but I want to get a response from both of you. You know, we've seen a growing concern among the Christian right about gender rights or gay rights or lesbian, gay, transgender, and bisexual rights. I'm wondering what you think this says when we have universities in a welcoming community like this saying, yeah, we want to make sure that all our students feel comfortable at our institution. Amy, let's start with you. There's a culture war going on in the midst of all this. So how does this play in that larger culture war?
I think it's important that the university is really supportive of all different communities. And this gender-inclusive living experience isn't the only one that's being offered. There's going to be a hall in one of the dorms next year for students interested in business and entrepreneurship. And that's a different community where students want to live within a group of people who understand their interests and understand who they are. There's also talk of introducing a hall that will be for veteran students coming back. So I think this is also indicating a trend that the university wants to accommodate different communities of students who want to live together, learn together, and be with one another in the university dorms, not only based on gender.
And Amanda?
Yeah, at Ohio University, we've been very intentional about ensuring that there are specialized living communities for different populations, not just learning community-based ones that are tied to a college or academic program, but in addition, specialized living communities that help our students that might have more transition issues to college. So whether that be an international hall or our gender-neutral housing initiative. So I think that what this demonstrates maybe isn't, you know, a waging into a culture war, but perhaps an understanding that our college students and our young people have needs and desires that we may not have been meeting prior, and that it's really incredibly important in the transition phase to college that they have a space that is theirs, that is safe and inclusive, and that is comfortable based on what their needs are, so that they can, in fact, sort of build a community that is the most positive and the best college experience that they can have.
Amy DeVob is the chair of the Open Housing Initiative at the University of Michigan. Thank you very much. Amanda Hobson is the residential coordinator at Ohio University. Thanks very much for talking to us about this.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Detroit is known worldwide for cars and for Motown, a sound that affected more than one generation. One of the tragic stories of Motown, though, is the life and death of Marvin Gaye.
Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way.
Prince of Motown struggled with loss, addiction, and finally was killed by his own father in 1984.
Father, father, we don't need to escalate.
So, let's start with you, Ziola. Why did you feel there was a need to set the record straight as far as other biographies of Marvin Gaye's life?
You know, you said it right there, to set the record straight. There were things that needed to be said, and the truth needed to come out. And I felt it was time to do this. And I want people to really know Marvin and know what went on in my household. And I just felt it was time to do that with all the inaccuracies that were, you know, filmed in other documentaries and books.
Can you give me one or two examples of the inaccuracies, the misperceptions by other authors?
Well, one good one is dealing with my father, for one thing, and the reason behind what happened that day on April the 1st. You know, a lot of people speculated as to what they thought happened, and they did not know because they were not there.
Angela Barrow Dunlap, this is a revival of a 2006 stage adaptation. You've got new information. Why did you feel there was a need to revive the play in this new format? Is it just simply because of these revelations within Ziola's new memoir?
Well, quite honestly, we never wanted to stop running the first time. And after discovering information and dealing with Gene and Ziola and discovering new information, we just felt even more compelled that although we did not have Marvin's music for the play, that we still had a very important story to tell, that there was so much just the dynamics of the family itself and that the message would help other families and just be important for Marvin's fans to know about the man behind the music, about, you know, the things that shaped him, about the family dynamics.
Ziola, you discovered your mother's journal and some writings from your father. What did those add to our knowledge about Marvin Gaye?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did find my sister and I found my mom's journal and my father's diary, and there were things in there very personal and things in it that we didn't know ourselves. So that's what has been incorporated into the new version of the play.
How are we going to view your brother Marvin differently now?
I don't know if it would change the way you view him or not, because most people just love Marvin because he was Marvin Gaye and he has such a message to send to the people. I just want people to come away with closure more so than anything else, and to knowing that when you understand something, you can heal more. You know, I want to heal people or help somebody out there by seeing my story, you know, because my family was dysfunctional, but so a lot of other families out there. And if they can see something in my story about my brother and my family that could help them, I feel that I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah, dysfunctional can mean a lot of things. What was it like growing up in that family?
Oh, you need to come and see the play. Let me say it was very interesting. You know, my family was a very interesting family. And, of course, you know, there was addiction running through the family. And that's the main thing I like to bring out, that if somebody else is addicted or you see some addiction in somebody that you love, that you, you know, take them and get them some help. We weren't able to do that with Marvin. My father was ill. He was an alcoholic. Marvin did drugs, and I did drugs. So, you know, it's that whole dynamic of just, you know, getting help for somebody else. And if I can help one person out there, then, you know, I feel like I've done what I'm supposed to do.
This is Stateside. We are speaking with Zeola Gaye, the author of My Brother Marvin and sister of the late Marvin Gaye, and Angela Barrow Dunlap, the playwright who directs My Brother Marvin, which is appearing at Fisher Theater in Detroit. Angela, I wanted to ask you, how will the play change the legacy of Marvin Gaye?
I think that it will help his fans to understand him more. I think that people feel so connected to Marvin. And, you know, we know his music. We can, you know, buy the records. We know his music. But we don't know the truth about life with Marvin. And no one can tell that better than Zeola Gaye, who was there in the home. There are only two individuals still living who grew up in the home with Marvin and understood those dynamics. Even the backstory of his mother and his father, we're dealing here with generational curses. And we're sharing some of that now in this new version of the play, the things that shaped his mother and made her the woman that she was, and the things that his father had to go through in his own childhood that helped to, you know, make him the man that he became, and you know, explains the problems that he had with his son.
Zeal, the last couple of days I've been asking different people, what do you know about Marvin Gaye? And they can name off three or four songs. Maybe they're bigger fans and know more about him. But they basically, people who aren't real big followers of Marvin Gaye, know a little bit of his music, and they know that he died at the hands of your father. How difficult was it to write this firsthand assessment of this horrible event for your memoir? And what's it like seeing it on stage or being reminded of it on stage on a regular basis?
Well, it was very difficult to write because I was addicted to drugs. It took a lot of years for me to be able to even put it down. I had to go to rehab, get clean, clear my mind out and clear my heart out, and then I was able to write it. And as I was writing, of course I feel it. I feel everything. You know, it's, to me, it was just like yesterday. And to answer your question, sometimes it's therapeutic for me to sit there and watch it. And then sometimes it's always extremely hard to see, but sometimes I can go away and feel a little more healing. And that's what I need to do. I get closure. It makes me feel like I'm handling it more. And I know it's been 28, 29 years, but it was something that was so impacted on my life. You know, I to answer your question, I don't know how I'm going to feel.
I have to say, the fans of Marvin Gaye must really appreciate your candidness, your honesty about what was going on in the family. Angela, I wanted to ask you, how do you capture this kind of emotion, this kind of sadness, and translate it into a format that's fit for the stage?
Well, we are so blessed to have cast Lynn Whitfield and Clifton Powell. Lynn Whitfield just brings to the character of Zeola's mother such depth. It's just really, in my opinion, certainly we had it on the page, but Lynn Whitfield and Clifton Powell, they make it come to life on stage. It's magical.
Right.
Well, we've been talking about the stage adaption of My Brother Marvin from a memoir written by Zeola Gay, who is Marvin's little sister, and the playwright and director of that performance, Angela Barrow Dunlap. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Absolutely.
Whoa. Oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind.
Here at Stateside, we want to connect with you. Find us online at michiganradio.org. On Facebook, just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. Offer up comments, suggest a story. Maybe you know someone who should be profiled. Coming up next, love is in the air. We'll bring you stories for Valentine's Day and the history of the holiday here in Michigan. This is Stateside. Hey, welcome back to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Now, we bring you stories for Valentine's Day from Michigan storyteller Allison Downey.
What's Valentine's Day?
It means you can give hugs or kisses. It's where you get great big hugs.
It means I love you and trick or treat.
Here I am at a bar in the middle of the afternoon. Don't judge me. I'm waiting for my husband. We're meeting for an early Valentine's Day date. Look at this guy at the end of the bar. He is checking out that woman over by the jukebox. Oh, he's making his move.
Excuse me. Hi, is your name Monica? Because I'm supposed to meet a girl here named Monica. It's a blind date. And she said she'd be wearing a red dress and just have the most beautiful brown hair and green eyes. You're not as...
I'm not. I'm sorry.
You're not. Oh, well.
Nope.
Well, that's a shame.
Is that true?
That right there was how I thought I would come introduce myself to you.
It felt like a pickup line.
It totally was. I came up with it over there by the jukebox.
You waited for like a pretty enough girl to walk in wearing
something. No, I saw you and what you were wearing and I thought I'd use that to my advantage.
Oh.
So, my name is Dustin.
Hi, I'm Rachel.
Rachel, what a beautiful name.
Thanks.
What does it mean?
It's just a name. I don't know. I've never looked it up.
Yeah, I guess I don't know.
It's biblical, that's for sure.
Okay, it sounds biblical.
Yeah. Man, that line worked.
Are
we're
you
talking.
Still? Yeah.
That hasn't been that long.
Okay. I thought we were beyond that. I thought maybe you'd forget how well that didn't work.
No, I'm going to remember that forever.
Well, that's quite a
promise. I wasn't saying we're going to be... I didn't say that. I was just saying, like, I'll...
You know, but it's weird because I'm studying psychology right now. What you just did there, you showed what you really want.
I don't know if I did. I could have meant forever, like I will retell this story to my friends at brunches forever.
Right, which could mean, you know, why would you tell like a fleeting moment story?
Oh,
who tells
brunches
those?
Are full of fleeting moment stories.
I don't tell my friends about that one time I sneezed and threw my neck out. Unless it comes up.
Did that happen to you?
It did.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
You should probably buy me a drink.
I will, bartender.
Hey, what can I get you?
I will have... What's she having? What are you drinking there?
Just whiskey on the rocks.
Oh, well, you know what? Make it a white Zinfandel for me and a whiskey on the rocks for her.
Oh.
You got it.
A white Zinfandel for you.
Yes.
Are you a big wine drinker?
No, I don't know why I just said that. You know, my mom drinks it. She calls it a good blush wine, so...
Was that a sneaky thing you do where you
talk
reference your mom
yeah,
so I know that you have a good relationship?
Yeah. How did you
God,
know
you
that?
Are good at this.
I gotta be honest, I started majoring in psychology to get...
Women?
To get women, but now I really enjoy it.
Dustin, not okay to admit to me on a first whatever.
On a first what?
I don't know.
All right.
Okay.
This is interesting right here.
I think it's a date.
All right, your word's not mine.
Well, here's to love at first sight. Let's hope it lasts. Now, my first love? That was definitely not love at first sight. Let's see. I was 16, and I had gotten this great opportunity to live with a family in Spain for the summer, a friend of a friend of my mom's. And I didn't know the family. I didn't even speak Spanish. But I was up for an adventure. I was naive and innocent and an extremely enthusiastic American, kind of like a puppy. So I wake up with my temples throbbing from the party of the century. And I find that what Antonio had drawn on my face the night before in permanent marker for all to see were not the flowers that he had told me, but male genitalia. This was not when I fell in love with Antonio. Now, at the time, Antonio was 19, and while his family lives in Madrid, for the month of August, the entire extended family of 40 gathers at their family's ancestral home on the coast of the Mediterranean. And this place even had a name. They called it Roda, or Rova. And it was here, at Roda, that Antonio and I became friends. Actually, more like siblings. And I think he would agree, given the marker incident. But at 20, I returned to Madrid to study for the year. I live and go to school right around the corner from his family's apartment, and they invite me for lunch every day. And Antonio is striking. He is tall with these deep Spanish doe eyes and a smile that just slayed me. He would pick me up after school on his moped, and we would zoom all around Madrid, and we'd go to art gallery openings, and we'd go dancing. And we were also total goofs together. I mean, we would make each other laugh till our bellies hurt. And I quickly grew desperately in love with Antonio. He was my perfect man. I could be completely myself with him, but I couldn't tell him how I felt. I was terrified of rejection, of losing this friendship, and I didn't know if he felt the same way or if he just wasn't into me. You know, the Spanish women were so beautiful and sophisticated, and I wasn't. I even asked Antonio if he had a girlfriend back in Japan where he had just returned from. He'd lived there for a year. And he said no, and he just never felt anything. It didn't feel really natural to him. They felt kind of uptight. And I was like, hey, I'm natural. And he seemed like he was into me. You know, we'd get all dressed up to go dancing. And he'd say, Alison, estás guapísima. Alison, you look so beautiful. So this went on for about 9 months, kind of pining away, but eventually I got to the point where I just accepted that we were going to be great friends. When, right before I'm about to leave, I'm about to turn 21, and he invites me to Roda, his family's home on the Mediterranean, just the two of us, for 5 days. We drive out of Madrid into Castilla León, that beautiful desert, craggly landscape, and into gypsy country. So Antonio asks me to play guitar for him. So I serenade him. And, well, I can't quite play like that, but, you know, I mean, it's a story, so I can pretend. The road turns from asphalt to dirt to sand to dust to cobblestone as we enter the archway into his family's compound. And we push open these enormous wooden doors with wrought iron that had been hanging there for centuries.
step onto the cold, hard Spanish tile floor. And there, framed in the doorway, with his coat of arms on one side and a painting that's older than our country on the other, Antonio looks like a prince. Which, I don't know, I guess was his lineage. And I'm wondering if we are going to go to the master bedroom when he says, Alison, my room is down this hallway and yours is down the other hallway. And my heart sinks. The next day, he takes me boating and we moor on this island. We get out of the boat and we're jumping around in the waves and we are splashing. We're just, you know, we're frolicking. We're frolicking in the waves. We're rolling in the surf and we roll until we come to a stop with Antonio right on top of me. And our eyes are locked. We've got sand dusting our cheeks. I can't hardly breathe. I'm just waiting for this kiss that's going to help me see God. When Antonio takes a breath and sort of shakes himself to and rolls off of me. And I sink into the sand. 7 years later, I'm living in New Mexico. I'm really happy. I get a call from Antonio, who has just moved to New York. And he's invited me to stay with him when I go there for my upcoming conference that summer. He has always promised me that if he ever came to the States, he would come see me. And I learned through the course of the conversation that he's actually been to the States several times to visit some friend of his named Stuart that he met on a business trip. And he not only did he not come to see me, he didn't even call. And I'm like, why didn't he call me? Why didn't he see me? You know, and who the hell is Stuart? And I'm on the plane and my mind is racing. And all of these pieces start fitting together to where we land in Central Park. I meet Antonio there to go for a run. And he says, Alison, there is something I have to tell you. And I blurt out, I know, I know, I know. We burst out laughing. And in my defense, I had a lot of gay friends. I mean, my roommate was gay, but it just never occurred to me with Antonio. And I ask, now, why didn't you tell me back then? And he says, Alison, because you confused me. Which was the best compliment he could have ever given me. I mean, it wasn't that I wasn't pretty enough or kind enough or fun enough. It was just that I wasn't man enough. That night, Antonio and Stuart take me dancing till 2 a.m, and we laugh all together till our bellies hurt. And I adore Stuart. He is so kind and funny and generous and smart. And I get it. Antonio had never really been my perfect man. He was Stuart's perfect man. And Stuart was his. It would take me many more adventures and a move to Michigan for me to find my perfect man, but I did. And so now, 17 years later, all the best of friends, when they take us boating, Stuart and Antonio frolic in the waves, and so do my husband, John, and I. Funny how sometimes our little disappointments work out for the best. But come on, let's face it. It's nicer to have the best without the little disappointments, right? That's my hope for our little couple at the end of the bar.
I mean, you really do look great.
Thanks.
But only time will tell. Oh, here's my husband. Hey, I gotta go. Have a great Valentine's Day. Whatever that means to you.
Alison Downey is a Michigan storyteller, musician, and associate professor at Western Michigan University. Joe Feldman and Mike Marinowski wrote and performed our fictional bar scene. The young children you heard at the beginning of the segment are students from the Learning Village Preschool in Kalamazoo. Zach Rosen produced our segment. Special thanks to Kyle Norris and Peggy Watson for their production help. Well, it's Valentine's Day, and for the cynical or the single, it's just another Hallmark holiday. But Hallmark has only been around for about 100 years, and Valentine's Day and Valentine's cards a lot longer than that. Joining us to talk about Valentine's Day in Michigan throughout the years is Bill Loomis. Bill writes for the Detroit News. He's author of Detroit's Delectable Past and Stateside's resident historian. Welcome back.
Hi, Lester. How you doing?
Just fine. Hey, good. You found Valentine's in Detroit predated the post office in Detroit. Yeah. What did Valentine's Day look like back then?
It started really in the 1840s, but nobody's quite sure where it started. But it was mainly young people running up to their hearts throbs home and dropping off a Valentine in the door and then running away. And all the sentiments and poetry were all handwritten and scented with perfume and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, I wanted to talk about that because today you go to a store, you buy a car, you send it out, mail it, or put it somewhere where your sweetie will find it. But cards or Valentines used to be a little more heartfelt, a little more inspired. How has the Valentine evolved over the years?
Back then, Valentine's Day was second only to Christmas for gift giving. I mean, it was serious business. In fact, one shop owner said that some of the Valentines that he sold weighed as much as Thanksgiving turkeys, which is kind of mixing holiday metaphors. But that's – I mean, they were elaborate, and they would have lace. One of them I read described had 6 yards of lace tied to it, and they would have garters, and they would have candy and all kinds of things. So picking a Valentine was no trivial thing. People would spend hours doing this sort of thing.
This is serious business.
Oh, that was. It definitely was. They were worth hundreds of dollars. The ultimate place to buy a Valentine was Paris, France. If you got a Parisian Valentine, you were really quite something.
And you're talking about – you mentioned some of these were like $100, which mid-19th century, $100, you could buy a couple of horses for that or more.
I know. One person said they were torn between buying a used car or a Valentine. That shows you how much these things were.
So last year you wrote this great piece in the Detroit News. It's entitled When Valentine's Day Meant Tender Effusions But No Spooning. And I think most of us think of spooning as curling up with someone front to back, but spooning hasn't always meant that. Tell us what spooning used to mean and why we have no spooning on Valentine's Day.
Yeah, the word spooning started around the 1870s. You start seeing it in the paper. And it could mean almost anything. It's a little vague. It didn't just mean kissing, making out, stuff like that. It could mean just simply holding hands or somebody was spooning. That meant they were, gaga in love with somebody else, goofy in love. One person described a mother and child relation as spooning when they were talking together with their hearts, that sort of thing. So it could mean almost anything. But in general, when it made the papers, it meant kissing and in public.
And I guess in the early 20th century, spooning was considered becoming a problem. The churches got involved. They either condemned it or you wrote about one church establishing spooning parlors so they could do it with chaperones.
Yeah, that's right. They labeled it the menace of spooning. But what they would do is working girls especially had – they lived in tenements or they lived in lodging homes where there was nowhere to meet. There was no lobby where you could even sit with your boyfriend.
Because you couldn't invite a gentleman to your room. That would really be frowned upon.
Yeah, no,
Your reputation would be ruined.
The spooning parlors were started by the churches to address that. And in New York they started. And there was also – they were in Chicago and they were in Detroit too. And basically they were a room. They'd have a fireplace and a sofa. And sometimes they'd have a stove where the girl might cook dinner for her beau. And they had long discussions. One article went on and on about how bright the lights should be and whether they should allow holding hands. They were fully chaperoned. And there was absolutely no kissing allowed. But and as bad as – or as – sterile as it seemed, there was long waiting lists for spooning parlors. You had to wait a long time.
Well, it seems today Valentine's messages are just as likely to be posted on Facebook rather than mailed or delivered to a sweetie. Restaurants and other businesses, like most holidays, kind of see this as just another marketing opportunity.
Sure.
So what's left of the romance, the love, the tender effusions of Valentine's Day?
Well, that's a good question. I think they're still there. I just think that it's never going to be as big a deal as it once was. And people have more opportunity to communicate. In those days, there really wasn't very many opportunities to say what you actually meant. I mean, the word effusion is an old-fashioned word that meant you know, like a frank and eager expression or utterances. And so tender effusions was an old phrase that meant just that. And there just wasn't that much. Valentine's Day you could cut loose and you could send the tackiest Valentine you could possibly imagine, and it was all in the name of love.
And somebody, hopefully, would be really ready to receive it.
That's right. They always were.
All right. Bill Loomis writes features for the Detroit News. He's also a food aficionado and wrote the book Detroit's Delectable Past. Bill, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks, Lester.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. The program was engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Maya Friedman, and Austin Davis. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again Monday at 3:00.